Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Jeff Jackson. His book is Miracopora, and it's published by $2 Radio, a young press. Every year, the Los Angeles Times Book Festival brings to Los Angeles a number of writers who have been nominated for book prizes. Jeff was nominated for one of the first novel prizes, and I read the group and I liked his the best. This is Miracopora, and I think we should begin by asking, what does that mean?
Well, Miracopora is an idiomatic Latin expression that means strange and unusual bodies.
Strange and unusual bodies. Now, does someone who reads this book have to have a command of idiomatic Latin expressions?
No, not at all. In fact, I picked the title mostly for the sound. I was looking for a title that would have sort of a beautiful poetic sound. I thought Mira sounds a little bit like mirror. Mira also to look at in Spanish. And corpora, I figured people could get their way to body. But really, it was about the sound. The book has so many different sections to it that I wanted to pick a title that wasn't going to sort of stamp some sort of meaning on the book. And instead, you'd read the book and the book itself would stamp some meaning on the title.
That's good. Now, I didn't find the book obscure at all. Did you?
No, I don't think it's an obscure book at all, despite the idiomatic Latin title of the book. I tried to actually write a book that gave the reader a lot of reasons to turn the page at every moment, to have moments that were exciting, to have moments of adventure in the book, and also to create a text that left the reader a lot of room to explore. For me, that was also really important, along with creating a sense of wanting to turn the page.
Because for me, it was a book about growing up. Growing up in the light of a difficult childhood. Didn't matter whether these events happened or not. One section involves feral children, a band of feral children. One section involves an interlude with a creepy mother and her iron punishing the boy for having ruined her blouse when ironing it, and now there's a wound on his back. One section has him visiting an abandoned zoo and carnival park. These all seem to me to be parts or meditations on childhood. The day when one's mother seems like a monster. The day when the best the world has to offer is going to Disneyland. That kind of thing taken and put in a new key signature. Slightly creepy, slightly lonely, but meant to be a comment on the thing as a whole.
Yeah, I'm glad you said the thing about the key signature as well. I mean, I was trying to take those sort of events in childhood and tweak them. And I was thinking partly of the tone as something that was a little dreamlike, a little hallucinatory, but not much. I was thinking of those first couple of moments when you're first waking up. And you can sort of feel the room around you, and it feels very tactile and real, but there's still just a little bit of dream logic at play. And I wanted that sort of combination of feeling that you're in a realistic setting, but that there's a little bit of dream logic happening. I think also when you're young, for me, there are days and weeks in childhood that feel so mythological, that sort of new things open up in your life that never repeat again. And I really wanted to capture that sense of these moments that are so important that become a sort of mythology for yourself and can become hopefully a mythology of a sort for readers.
Well, I remember, too, that when I was young and I was in school, kindergarten went from 9 in the morning to 12 noon. But suddenly, maybe it was second grade, it went from 9 in the morning to 3 p.m. And that sitting in a chair, wondering if when I grow up, other things will seem as slow as this does to me. Am I always going to feel this kind of sense that time is stretching out and stretching me with it, almost like torture, like on a rack?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true of childhood. There's a great Bruno Schultz story about when August sometimes grows extra weeks. And I think that that's absolutely true of childhood, that there are moments when weeks in childhood grow extra weeks within them. And I remember going to a Dutch preschool. I grew up in Aruba, and it was this Dutch immersion preschool, and everyone around me was speaking Dutch, and I didn't know it. That week there is ingrained in my mind as an 8-month period that was somehow unending and somewhat still unending in my mind.
Wow. Now, how did it happen to be Aruba?
My parents, I moved there when I was about 9 months old, and my father worked for Exxon, which had an oil refinery there. And so we grew up in Aruba, which is like a desert island with beautiful beaches, sort of like Arizona. There was very little tourism when we were there, and there was this odd sort of expatriate colony. And it was just, it was a very strange and wonderful landscape to grow up in, that there was no television. Well, there was television, but it was on for like 3 hours a day, and we would get cartoons from World War II. So I learned about saving my scrap metal and important things like that. I didn't realize how dreamlike it was until years later when we moved to the United States, when I moved to Miami and then later to New Jersey, how unusual my childhood in Aruba had been. I mean, I think every childhood you take for granted as this is just what it is. And everyone's childhood is, of course, unusual in different ways. But growing up in Aruba, I think, made me always sort of look at the United States with a little bit of an outside eye and feel a little bit a few steps apart from the country in some ways.
Let's hear the very beginning. It begins straightforwardly with a chapter called I Begin. Why not? Let's begin.
As all first novels should begin. I begin. There's an empty notebook in the bottom drawer of my desk. I place it on a flat surface. I fold it open to the third page. I tap my pen against the paper 3 times. Then I draw the picture of a door, and beneath it write the word open. The floor beneath me begins to shift. I keep my eyes fixed on the page, where the door is now ajar to reveal a staircase. I enter the page and walk down the steps. In pitch dark, I feel the way with my hands, running my fingertips along the walls. I move slow and breathe deep. There's a bottom, and my feet experience the relief of flat ground. I stand still and let my eyes adjust. A pinpoint of light beckons in the distance. I follow its faint glow as I move down the corridor. Soon I enter a round room with no windows. Torches encircle the rough stone walls. A wooden altar stands at the center of the space. I look closer. A boy with alabaster skin, always alabaster, is tied to the altar with twine. He's bare except for a modest loincloth, and I can see the blue veins beneath his pale skin. A delicate specimen. His body briefly spasms in a struggle against his bonds, but it's just a twinge of animal instinct without much conviction. I'm careful to prepare this sacrament correctly. I start by plucking the stray hairs from the boy's otherwise smooth chest. Soon his skin appears as blank as a page. A steel dagger lies next to the body. I grip it tightly. As I approach the empty surface, the blade feels as sharp as a quill. I'm ready to begin.
The opening of Jeff Jackson's Miracorpora. Okay, now what is this? Creepy.
Creepy, it's also an invocation. It's a ritual. It's a ritual into writing. It's a ritual into how do we tell our stories. And how we tell our stories is an exciting process, but it's also a creepy process and a disturbing process and a process that may ask a little bit more of us than we're willing to give. I think there's something about telling our stories as this ultimately cathartic act. And I think about Harry Cruse talking about when he wrote Childhood, Biography of a Place. And he said he wanted to write it as precisely as he could so he could get all his demons out and they would be gone forever. But when he finished the book, it had almost killed him, and he realized that all he had done is turn up the volume on his demons and made them more present than ever. That sometimes writing about these things that we think we can expunge them, all we're doing is inviting them into our life in a deeper way. And I think that's one of the risks of writing. And I think that it should be treated as a risk.
So in other words, this is an invocation, but we don't know what's being invoked.
Yeah. We hope that something positive is being invoked. We hope that through this sort of sacrifice, something positive is being invoked, but we're not sure. I mean, there's also the sense of it's a story. It starts out as a story about a young boy. It sort of follows him chronologically. And there's a sense of writing as sort of sacrificing your younger self.
Now, the book is in a number of chapters that have interludes between them. You just heard one interlude, I begin, another is called I continue, and the third, of course, is called I end. I am going to ask my guest, Jeff Jackson, to read the very first section of the first chapter called My Year Zero, 6 years old.
All right. So this is the opening paragraph of the first chapter. They take me out hunting for strays. People stride through the woods and shout things at one another. They practice popping guns on their shoulders and breaking them in half so the empty shells tumble to the ground. Everybody here is older than me. I'm small and constantly underfoot. It's the afternoon, or something like that. Sunlight breaks through the trees to illuminate kaleidoscopic patterns on the forest floor. Pine needles, fallen leaves, patches of dirt. The pack of stray dogs barks in the distance. These are the first things I remember. Gunshots, popping sounds, little bursts of gray powder blooming from the end of each rifle.
Okay, so we've had this invocation, and now, finger snap, we're somewhere.
Yes.
And the sense of this book is, well, what they used to call picaresque. We're going to be in a series of somewheres, some of which have to do with one another, all of which have to do with growing up, and we don't know quite where we will be next, yes?
Right. I was definitely interested in putting the reader into the story immediately and letting you sort of find your way as it goes along. And that was important to me, and that's something for me that's pleasurable as a reader. I love being sort of rocketed into a story without preamble, without a lot of throat clearing. In earlier drafts, there was some throat clearing, and I tried to get rid of that as much as possible. And in terms of the picaresque, it is definitely moving from event to event. However, I think the thing that keeps it together is the repeat of certain images. There's a repeat of certain themes and images, and that's what's collecting rather than necessarily returning to the same characters again and again. We have the same narrator throughout the book, and there's one or two characters, the mother comes back. But in a lot of cases, it's really more the images that are repeating. It's more the themes that are repeating, some of the gestures and rituals that are repeating, and how the repetition of those things creates meaning.
What are some of the images that recur?
Well, some of the images are oranges. dogs are another image that repeats. Rituals repeat sort of sacrifices and funerals.
There are packs of stray dogs,
yeah.
Packs of stray children.
Right.
And it's sort of as if, in order to live, this narrator is going to have to differentiate himself from the pack.
Yeah, and early on, he's someone who's very much, as I think a lot of children are early on, someone who's an observer, someone who's standing back, someone who's trying to figure out even a little bit, like the reader is, who these packs are, how these packs operate. Are these packs that he wants to belong to? And then realizing how he's different from these packs, and how it can be okay to be different from these packs, and sort of slowly finding his own path that he needs to follow.
So in a way, the book is like, for me, a kid, maybe 12 or 13, finding a rock and roll record that he knows he can't play for his parents.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I'm glad you mentioned the rock and roll, because that's another repeating motif, another repeating image is music, and this cassette that the narrator gets when he's around 12 or 13. And it's one of those moments that people who love music have fortunately had, of hearing something and feeling like their world has turned upside down, that they have this sort of secret knowledge that other people don't have.
And also that quality in childhood that you get where you suddenly think, I'm thinking this, seeing this, hearing this, and no one has ever thought it, seen it, heard it before.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the primary things about childhood and why everything when you're a young adult is so important, is because you're going through it for the first time. And every moment feels like potentially the beginning of the world or the end of the world. And very little sort of feels like the mundane middle of the world. And that's something I think is key for the book, and something I was also trying to play with a little bit too, and trying to take those moments and also defamiliarize them a little bit so that hopefully for the reader, they also feel fresh. There's so many coming of age stories. They've just been done to death, that I really wanted to try and find images and find different tonalities and different keys so that these moments would also feel fresh for the reader and feel at least a little bit for the reader like they're going through them for the first time too.
Well, the very cool Don DeLillo read this book and said that it felt, what kind of present tense did he name it?
He said it was present tense with a vengeance, which was wonderful.
Yes, it is wonderful. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Jeff Jackson about his first book, Mira Corpora. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. And I'm talking with Jeff Jackson about his new book, Mira Corpora, a coming-of-age story haunted by ugly childhood memories. Now, I'm curious about the ongoing sense of sadism. The mother with her hot iron, a sense that this childhood doesn't have innocence as one of its qualities.
I'm not entirely sure there isn't innocence in there. I mean, there are dark parts of the book, and there are some sections of abuse, but I do feel that the way the narrator is looking at and experiencing some of these things, the world around him isn't innocent. But I think there's something in the narrative voice, at least I tried to put something in the narrative voice, that there is still some innocence. That the way that he's perceiving what's happening to him and the way he's looking at the world, there's still room for moments of beauty. There's still room for, unfortunately, for him to get duped at times, because he still, despite all this, there is a little bit of a trusting nature to him.
Now, the boy sees a girl in a window opposite his mother's house, and she seems to be the source of the oranges that recur throughout the novel. His mother will teach him to cut them open. And it seems almost as if the women in the book offer a progressive form of instruction and education, in What to Do with Sweetness.
I love that. I hadn't thought of it in quite that way.
How did you think of it?
I think that's right. I think that's right. I mean, certainly the narrator is looking for sweetness from his mother and not getting it in the way he wants. He's learning how to carve an orange, but not how to savor an orange. He's not really learning about the sweetness that he really needs. What he's getting from the girl in the window is this sort of offering from her, which is really wonderful. And yet what he learns from his mother about the situation that this girl might be in sort of changes the context. It even changes the taste of the oranges for him that he's taken from her. And that's a sort of painful education for him. There's another woman who takes him in later in the book who's pregnant. Who's also very kind to him and shows him a sort of kindness and shows him a sort of protection that his own mother doesn't give him. And yet she's also selling out some ideals, selling herself out in some ways that are also very disturbing. So these women are sort of constantly, like a lot of people in the book, sort of moving back and forth between sweetness and this sort of the sweetness that the taste changes in your mouth.
Now, what interests me truly is that there have been many comparisons made between this book and the work of Dennis Cooper. But I think that the largest difference is the presence of these female characters. This is a book which will go into the arena where the boy becomes a sex slave to a man. But it really is not the gay fiction. And I think that part of what the book needed to do for you was pull itself out from the transgressive arena of gay fiction to find a way to be heterosexual and still transgressive.
Yeah, I mean, Dennis is a huge influence on my work, and finding Dennis's novels was in some ways like finding one of the keys that helped to open up some of my writing, and I owe him a huge debt in that regard. But the narrator is largely is heterosexual, and he has a first sexual encounter with a woman in the woods with the feral children where he's living. And he does, although he does become a sex slave in a certain regard, he enters into this certain partnership with this man who's clearly exploiting him. He's saved in some ways by that from two different women. There's one woman who tries to help him escape. There's another woman, the pregnant woman, who offers him sanctuary and protection. So it's a different world than the world that's sort of populated by Dennis's fiction. I mean, the fact that he comes under the sway of this predator and this predator happens to be gay is almost in some ways incidental. It's more about the power dynamic.
Well, I want to examine that
okay.
for a second, because you see, I think Dennis Cooper was such a meteor crossing the sky of contemporary literature that all sorts of writing teachers have told me that it became impossible to persuade young, completely, or if there is such a thing as completely heterosexual writers, that they were not going to be doing themselves any good by writing another chapter of a book that might have come from Dennis Cooper, that it became a given that this was what was happening in young American fiction, and that it became almost an inevitable influence if a book was experimental or, as we've been saying, creepy. And I wondered, as a young writer, this is your first novel, are you coming up from it's perfectly natural that Dennis would leave a stamp on this book, and yet I have the feeling that this is about escaping the planet of Dennis Cooper.
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way, but there is.
Of course not.
but there's certainly there's I'm sure more than a little truth to that. I mean, it's interesting because this is my first novel, but I'm a little bit older. And when I was in grad school writing, Dennis wasn't an influence among the younger writers. It was writing that was much more conservative, and so finding Dennis for me was it was a real sort of liberation to find his writing and to find the way that he approached style and structure, the way that he has of inflecting a lot of emotion into the prose itself without ever being sentimental. And that was a huge influence. But there's a lot of other influences in the book. You know, Donald Barthelme was had a huge impact on me. Isaac Babel was like a meteor for me when I discovered his writing. Joan Didion and Don DeLillo, as you mentioned. Dennis Johnson as well. I don't know, Nabokov and Cortazar. I could go on and on. But yeah, I do think that you're right that because I think Dennis was one of sort of the last keys that I found that helped me to sort of unlock what I wanted to do with my writing, that then I needed to find a way to push beyond that. Hopefully the next books will keep doing that as well. I mean, I think the best way to pay tribute to a writer that you really love is to not imitate them at all, is to work your way out from under their shadow as quickly as possible, that the true disciples of someone don't look anything like their masters.
I've been talking with Jeff Jackson, author of Miracopora, published by $2 Radio. Thank you, Jeff, for joining me.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
I like to have first novelists, especially when the book is as interesting and strange as Miracopora. Thank you. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Miracopora at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Jane Parshall, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Jeff Vandermeer is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.